Good morning, neighbors. This is Long John with the party line. We're around from midnight to 5:30, 6 mornings during the week. Monday mornings, we get started about 1, continue through to 5:30. That means we're on the air for some 37 and a half hours a week, and during that time, I have the pleasure of talking to as many interesting people. Tonight, we're going to be talking with Margaret Storm. Margaret has been with us before. And we're going to be talking about her new book, Return of the Dove. Now, this is a very, very exciting book. You may not buy everything that Margaret speaks in her book, but you certainly will be interested in reading it. Margaret tells us a lot about Tesla, or Tesla. Never will find out what the correct pronunciation is. And something about the machines, and well, we'll learn more about it as we go along. Return of the Dove is the title of the book, The Story of Freedom's Star. Incidentally, I had the opportunity of talking with Margaret at great length when we were out at Oklahoma City. And she told me some very, very interesting things, which I hope that we'll be able to get into this morning. Some things about the I Am movement, which was very popular back in the 30s. And you stick with us, and we got some interesting material for you this morning. Ellery Lanier, author and lecturer, is with us this morning. Eden Gray of Inspiration House is with us. And
the American sportswriter, Candy Kaplan, and Bold Handicap.
I saw him. That's nice. No further comments. With our guests of the morning, Margaret, I think that she spent about 2 or 3 additional days in Oklahoma City.
They finally asked me what happened after we left.
Let me just ask you this. Were you disappointed when the OCC circular foil craft failed to get off the ground?
No, I was not disappointed at all. I just feel that when it's ready to go up, it will go up. And,
fine, fine.
And so I think it was just a planned date, as I understand it, and
since Alice had, the way they should, was not planned.
You know, they had, using your term, they had 3 planned dates.
Oh, I thought they had 4.
Well, I'm not aware of the fourth one. I know it's 3. But this was not disturbing to you. It was not a disappointment. You just took it in.
No, I think that under the circumstances of Mr. Carr in the hospital, that it will be much better when he has fully recovered and he launches it himself.
What will be much better? The craft or Mr. Carr?
Both, and also the launching. I think it will be much better for the general public, shall we say. There was a considerable comment by several persons who thought that Mr. Kraft had invented something that anyone could just put together and launch. And I believe this proved that it was something more than just an ordinary a craft. It could be launched by any airplane designer.
You say it proved? What do you mean it proved? In other words, the fact that it didn't get off the ground, it didn't even get out of the abandoned shack, means that it's better?
No, I talked with Otis on Wednesday night before I left, and he had been giving instructions from his hospital bed and connected with the winding the circuit and so forth. And he told me that when he went out there on Wednesday afternoon after he got out of the hospital and the craft had been partly dismantled so that he could look at it, and he immediately saw what the trouble was and realized that...
Is it just a minor adjustment that's necessary?
He seemed to think that it would be just a minor adjustment, although he did tell me that while he had the craft apart, he was going to do considerable more work on it, because there were other factors which had not been carried out according to his instructions.
Was he unhappy with his original plan, or was he unhappy with the mechanics?
Well, I think that he was not unhappy at all. He felt very cheerful about the whole thing, but naturally, I believe from
Shortcuts had been taken in the mechanical work, which he felt might as well be improved while he was had an opportunity to work on it.
What could he be happy about? Tell me. I mean, also, we're all very happy that he's regained his health. But, I mean, other than that, what is there to be happy about a craft that never even got out of the laboratory?
Well, I guess that he realizes that it's just about ready, and it's sort of like writing a book, you know. I started being happy about having my book finished when I had just written the title, you know.
That's pretty good. One more quick question. I got a lot of questions for you, matter, but one in particular. You say that Mr. Carr, Otis T. Carr, was giving instructions from his hospital room to the people working in the laboratory.
In the shed or whatever it was.
Yeah, well, I mean, one sometimes, you know, if I'm in a good mood, I say laboratory.
Oh,
I say
laboratory.
Whatever it may be. Uh-huh. The place that it was in.
Bathroom,
right?
Yeah.
Margaret, why was it necessary for the Great One to give this information from his hospital bed if he had a set of plans, or didn't they have a set of plans to work by?
That I do not know. You see, I was not there, and I never did see the craft, you know, or this place it was in. I had an opportunity to go out there a couple of times, but I just couldn't bother. And I believe that they possibly did have the plans. I don't know about that, because Mr. Herbert was the one working up there for some time. And, but I believe that toward the end, there were certain things that, even though they were available in some set of plans, they were not available for the general workman. In other words, there were certain things that Mr. Carr explained piece by piece as he went along.
You say that, Margaret?
Oh, yes.
In the eventual success of the craft.
That's right, yes.
Why are you so kind?
Well, because it's time that free energy is should be launched, and if Mr. Carr's craft should for some reason not be completed, there will be others that very similar, which will be, I feel.
In other words, you feel if Carr doesn't get there first, that somebody else will be along and will make the grade.
Well, as I understand it, there are many persons who, not many, but perhaps thousands, who would be able to complete the craft. Either
complete Carr's idea?
Well, or a similar idea, yes. And if for some reason Mr. Carr does not do it himself, why, there would be others available who would do it. And Mr. Carr realizes that, and I also understand that there are many other aspects of free energy which will be developed as soon as Mr. Carr's craft is launched. In other words, it's just a matter of pioneering. Mr. Carr is doing more of a pioneering job than anything else.
Well, let us for a moment just agree with you that there's possibly pioneering, and let us say that he's the first one to accomplish this. What benefit will he gain from all this if Lanier and Pack and Sam Jones and Sidney Smith and 40 other guys are planning on the same thing, supposing they come out with it 2 or 3 days later? How will Carr break even? Now, when I say break even, in other words, certainly Mr. Carr is entitled to something, and the people associated with him. No doubt there was a tremendous amount of money invested to build this craft. Taking all of that into consideration, if everybody is trying to do the same thing, and let's say that they don't accomplish it on Monday, Carr accomplishes it on Monday, and they come along on Wednesday or Thursday or 6 months later, what will Carr have that he can make a dollar on? And he's certainly entitled to something.
Mr. Carr told me a long time ago that in the course of his 30 years of research work, that he had come across possibly 100 different ideas for the development of free energy devices. Out of these, he finally selected two. One has come out as the neutron accumulator, the other as the Kurata gravity motor. The neutron accumulator, which is the device used in the spaceship under consideration, is only for motion application. That is, it can be used in planes or trains, automobiles,
steamships, boats, anything that moves. However, that natural limit for application, and the real thing that we will be interested in will be the free energy device which Mr. Carr calls the Kurata gravity motor, which can be used in all fixed locations, for instance, for home units or factory units. In other words, this can be installed in a home, and you can build your home out in the desert or the forest. It will supply you with all the electricity you need to light your home and heat it, cool it, and operate various electrical gadgets. This, therefore, is a very practical thing. There are very few persons who are going to need spaceships. And, of course, as time goes on, trains, planes, and boats, steamships, that sort of thing can be powered by the neutron accumulator. And the little space mobiles, which our plans will, to a large extent, replace automobiles. But there are many other devices, even at present time, which can be used to power automobiles, for instance, and they can therefore be operated without fuel. But the Kurata gravity motor is the thing that is going to be in worldwide use.
What was that name?
Kurata gravity motor, because that is the practical device for fixed locations. Therefore, while it will be very interesting to have the neutron accumulator demonstrated in a spaceship, as I say, not many persons will be interested in spaceships.
I'm sitting here in complete amazement. Complete amazement.
Why? Do you think there are many people interested in spaceships?
No. I imagine we all are. I went out and spent 4 days because of my interest. I enjoyed myself. I had a wonderful time out there. Did you want to comment? I have a letter here.
Oh, before you ask the letter, I just want to say that most of the great inventors of our times are the great experimenters have not exactly set their sights upon the peak at the first crack. In other words, Edison didn't try. He never looked at a small light which might possibly light up a small room or a portion of the room. This is what surprises me about Mr. Carr, because I should think that these great inventions which are going to run our air conditioning and keep all the dust out of the air would be the first thing that he would try to work on, not the spacecraft, which is a little bit of the, should we say, it takes in a lot of problems that don't have anything to do with free energy.
Well, that is correct. The spaceship seems to be of great interest for demonstration purposes, and I noticed quite a difference in the attitude of the people out in Oklahoma, especially certain ones that I talked to who, such as the architect, Mr. Foley, who flew up from Miami for the 19th. Of course, he's been up two or three times before, and he's arranging to start on the work of the Space Research Institute, which will be used for the development of these various devices. The spaceship, therefore, the little 6-foot prototype, was simply more or less to satisfy the curiosity of those who wanted the demonstration, and it could be demonstrated rather easily. That is, because it's sent up
Whereas it's difficult to demonstrate the Corrales gravity motor or anything of that sort, which is, which is a small unit.
Well, if he could even melt my flow cell with this free energy, I would be impressed. You'd have to send the spaceship up into the air.
There is one other thing, and that is that these 6-foot prototype spaceship can be used for two purposes. That is, it can be enlarged to a 9 or 10 foot model and used as a space mobile with very little change.
What's a space mobile, Margaret?
Well, a space mobile will replace the automobiles eventually, we hope, such as it can be used for loading purposes, or it can be used for long trips or trips around the world, or fly at fantastic speed. It's highly maneuverable and will not require any fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it should be extremely popular to replace automobiles. The other reason that Mr. Clare is very interested in the spaceship is because he seems to have some desire to build the OCCS around the 45-foot model and make it just from Earth. While he's interested in going to the moon ever and ever.
And I want to ask you something, Margaret, right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just before we took a moment to talk about one of our favorite sponsors, the General Tire and Rubber Dealers, you said something about the development and the successful launching of the OTC circular foil craft, the 6-foot prototype model, would naturally encourage Otis to complete the 45-foot model, go to the moon, and you said you were wondering why he wanted to go to the moon. Are you saying that you don't think that Carr will be able to make it on December 7th, 1959 because of the failure to launch it this past April 19th?
Oh, no, I don't think that would have anything to do with it. As a matter of fact, according to what Otis told me, the 45-foot model is supposed to be ready for testing along about October. And should certainly be ready to go to the
45-foot level?
That's what I said.
So you're not talking about the ride that they have in the...
No, I'm being sincere. No, well, he said that some people thought he might take off in that, but he didn't intend to take off. And, the 45-foot model, I understand, is pretty well on its way. That is, so far as the planning is concerned, and that sort of thing.
The planning?
Yes,
construction?
Oh, then they haven't actually started the construction. As I understand it, they have to wait for the hangar, but I believe that the hangar is ready to be built.
Still having more leaking mercury, that's very messy.
No, the hangar is part of the complex of buildings in the Space Research Institute.
Do you mean they don't have sufficient space to build this hangar because of the other buildings that are planned at the present time?
No, the hangar is one of the main buildings, and formerly it was supposed to be built just along with all the other buildings. But under present plans, it will be built almost immediately. They will start work on it first.
Mrs. Storm, is this down in Space, Maryland? Or
no,
this
is in Space, Oklahoma now.
Aren't they going to do anything in Maryland? Is Maryland given up?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's given up because they probably will have many of these space research institutes, we will say, sometime in the future, years in the future. But the first one now will be in Space, Oklahoma.
I see. And that's where the big one is going to be built.
Well, yes, that Space Research Institute, as I understand it, is also a prototype in that when this free energy really gets launched, they will have to have several of them. And then at that time, they might have one in space now.
Margaret, I want to ask you a question, and I want a fair and square answer to it.
Yes.
Do you honestly think that Otis B. Carr has the slightest intention of even attempting to go to the moon? And I'm not going to hold you to December 7th or anything. I don't care if it's 2 years now. Do you honestly think that this man has a legitimate intention to go to the moon?
Well, he seems to have. As I say, I don't understand why anyone would want to go to the moon, but if he wants to go and wants to build his own ship and take off, try to reach the moon, why, that is his problem and his privilege.
Well, you don't think that he's just going to go on an excursion, that he'd like to see what the moon looks like. I think he's trying to be the first and to prove to the world that he can build a craft that would go there. Don't you think that's his intention, if he has a legitimate intention in that direction?
Well, I don't know. I have discussed it with him several times, and I get the idea, although he hasn't really explained it very clearly, but I rather feel that he thinks that it would go far towards solving the military problem. In other words, if he would make a trip to the moon and bring back some information and data, then possibly this would clear up a lot of troubles they seem to be having about military questions in regard to the moon and flight into outer space, although I wouldn't think that a flight to the moon would be exactly considered flight into outer space. That's not my concept.
It wouldn't be?
I'm
not saying you're wrong.
I don't think so. I mean, it seems to me that the moon, being our satellite, that perhaps the conditions would be quite different from what they might be if you would go off beyond that into what we would call outer space, such as a trip to another planet.
Valerie, how do you feel about that? Would that be considered outer space, a trip to the moon?
Well, I think according to a discussion held in the Congress of the United States, outer space is considered the area where the atmosphere of the Earth ends. So this would automatically, I mean, according to the Congress of the United States, be called going into outer space. But it still remains a matter of your personal definition.
Well, as a scientist, what would be your definition?
Well, I would say very definitely Mr. Otis T. Carr will be going into outer space.
If he really...
If his saucer takes off.
Mm-hmm. We have Margaret Storm here for a purpose. We want to talk about this book, which is a very exciting book. That is for the people that are interested in precognition, ESP, and what have you, and trance mediums and all. We're going to get all the information from her. But I don't think we've given you the opportunity since we've been back to give us your opinion of what happened in Oklahoma City, Ellery. You were the last one to leave it, with the exception of Margaret. Margaret stayed, I think, an additional day. Did you want to...
Well, I have something for the historical record. I definitely, with my own eyes, saw the six-foot model come off the floor. It came up from the ground, in effect. But I was one of about eight or so many men standing around the craft, lifting it up to
looking
a table
up
in the middle of the... I'm being a little facetious, but I think for the historical record, I would like to include that. And I would also add that there were two things that impressed me tremendously. One was the Frontier City Ride model, the facsimile of a flying saucer. When we were standing, I think, John, you will recall we were standing inside the saucer, and the mechanism for spinning the outer rims of the saucer went into action, and we could see these huge double cones spinning past under the gigantic C-shaped magnets. This was a most impressive thing. I thought at any moment it might blow up the entire planet. It was a tremendously exciting experience. And then the second thing that impressed me very powerfully was the six-foot model. When we got in there, we were the first people to see the inner works outside of anyone who had worked on the machine. And all the elaborate electrical connections and the windings around various magnets certainly were impressive as any computing gadget with its millions of wires and connections inside. And I really couldn't make head or tail of it, but it was very obvious that this was something like a great big electric motor, and if that thing started to turn, something was going to happen.
I know that you've been rather reluctant to say this, but I talked with somebody over at True Magazine today about some other matter completely foreign to our discussion of the morning. And according to what I've been told over there, certainly not from Doug Kennedy, because I didn't talk to him today, I understand that you are doing an article for True Magazine about what happened in Oklahoma City. Is that true?
That is true, John. I don't know the exact date of the completion of the article. I'm in the midst of it now, and it's one of the most interesting jobs I've ever worked on.
It'll be a complete coverage of what happened out there.
It'll cover the entire story of the expedition of the Long John troop, as Ben Rice referred to the crew to the caravan, and the events of observing the model saucer and what happened when the saucer did or didn't rise, and so on. It will be, in effect, the first description of the first attempt of the new Columbus, which didn't quite come off, but which we expect to come off very soon.
Ellery, I'd like to ask you this. Then a lot of people from all over the country, I understand, came out there to watch this. And, of course, they didn't see it rise, but were they allowed to go into the warehouse or wherever it was and see this craft at all, or did they have to go away without seeing anything?
They did see the craft. There were certain small parts of the inside of the machine that were covered with some sheets of paper or fabric taped over, just very small details of the mechanism. But the people did see the 6-foot prototype model, and I know I was there when there were many members of the press present when they saw this 6-foot model was spinning. It was actually simulating the motion in which it would go into flight. And that was a tremendously impressive sight, to watch this 6-foot disc of shining, silvery metal spinning in the middle of this abandoned warehouse.
Lord Pat, well, I'd like to go back to start in on The Return of the Dove, the very interesting book by Margaret Storm, which is, I think, published by Miss Storm also.
Yes, I'm publishing now, too.
Yes, I must confess to you, Margaret, that I'm to listen to Otis T. Carr mention Nikola Tesla, I guess that was the pronunciation. I had never heard of the man, frankly. And I read your book, and this made me more and more interested in Mr. Tesla, the late Mr. Tesla. And I was stunned to read of his accomplishments, especially the alternating current and things like this. And I see that the magazine you just mentioned, True, labeled him the man who invented the 20th century. He's alive 87 years, yet he must have lived a great deal in obscurity, didn't he?
Well, I believe that during his later years, he lived a rather obscure life. But during his early years in the United States, of course, he came over here when he was quite a young man. He received all of his education in Europe. And during his early years in the United States, he was extremely popular socially. And he dined each night at the Waldorf or Delmonico's. And he was very, he gave a great many dinner parties and that sort of thing. And he entertained quite frequently at his laboratory on, I think it's now West Broadway, South Fifth Avenue in those days. And he often had many guests come down there and that down there.
Well,
he's quite one of our most in the world of
The thing that amazes me, Margaret, is that it's been so many years since I went to school, but I still remember pretty well. And my oldest daughter is going to high school now and studying physics and things like this. And this is alternating current. Nowhere in the books that they read is his name mentioned. It's a terrible loss.
It is, yes. Well, of course, my understanding is that it was purposely suppressed. And, of course, he left more than 1,200 major inventions, which is the Matthews and Mr. Arthur H. Matthews in Canada. But yet, most of his inventions were suppressed, and the public has no knowledge of them whatsoever.
Well, the business about the alternating current is fabulous because I think the job of changing over in New York City hasn't even been completed, if I'm not mistaken. Now, there's still some
difficult for people who don't have equipment such as our current.
Our alternating current, actually, of course, is much safer as well as being more practical. And I just can't understand this this suppression. Is there any reason for it, do you know?
Perhaps Mr. Castro himself had something to do with that, in that he was such a great inventive genius, and he had such tremendous plans for the globe. He never considered anything any smaller than that. And he had he had a habit of obsoleting his own inventions. And this caused the manufacturers much distress, because by the time they got all ready and set to turn out to mass produce something that he had invented, why, he would have a new invention which would obsolete that. This happened in the case of alternating current, because he came up very shortly after that with this tremendous world wireless power system, and he said that should be used instead. That is, the power should be, there should be no wires or cables or conduits. The electricity should be beamed, somewhat like a radio broadcast.
Well, is this time to do with free energy also?
Well, no, not in the sense that it ties in with anything that OTC Carr is doing. Now, that's a different thing.
Margaret, this question that Warren has just asked you is one of the great things that Tesla almost accomplished. And, of course, it would change our entire civilization if this thing came about. All electric wiring would simply disappear.
That's right.
And you could have power available anywhere. What I want to ask you is, number one, is that this was really serious. This wasn't any flippant joke or imaginative line of research. This was something that Nikola Tesla was very seriously working on, as far as you know.
Oh, yes, he had completed it, I think we could have had it around the turn of the century, possibly even before. And if we had used it at the time that he suggested, then it could have been used when the electrical age was being built up and developed, so that we would not have put up all these wires. Now, he was very, very forceful on that one point. He said, do not put up all of these wires and cables and towers and so forth, because you will only have to take them down. And many persons in those have no idea what he was thinking of. But he was thinking of the swimming space mobiles or spaceships.
Did he tell anyone about the system, or did he leave any record of how it was done?
Oh, my, yes. That was just well known, and it has been written up extensively in many scientific journals and so forth. And you can get complete information on that. In fact, a great deal of the description is contained in Practical Genius.
Of this transmission of energy without wires.
That's right.
The
atmosphere. Mm-hmm. That's right.
I seem to recall that there was one idea for the use of this concept of to have airplanes flying without gasoline motors, just a simple motor that would receive its power from the ground. It wouldn't need batteries or anything.
That's the Tesla Sphere, which he invented and gave to the United States late in 1917 to help them win the First World War. This was simply filed, I believe, because it was a circular foil craft. It carried no power plant, but the power plant was on the ground, and the power was beamed to the plane. This was not built by the United States, and was in fact completely ignored. And after 40 years, however, the Russians have placed it in production, and I understand it is very successfully used in Russia today.
Well, Mr. Storm, didn't Mr. Tesla also give a demonstration in front of a great many people of a small ship in a pond in which he beamed directions to it, didn't he?
Yes, it was a demonstration of clock control. Yes.
Well, that was electricity, wasn't it? I mean,
that was definitely clock control. That was something else which was not understood at that time at all. Mr. Matthews tells me that the new spaceships which are coming in from other planets now, many of them have landed at his place, are entirely directed by thought control.
Oh.
And Mr. Carr understands that too, because Mr. Carr told me some time ago that he said when this craft, the OTCX-1, is built, he said, of course, it will be nothing but an old tin Lizzie, because it will be so old-fashioned.
Yes. Well, but on this business of beaming energy, I think one of the things I did read was that Mr. Tesla just had some electric light bulbs at odd places around the ceiling of his laboratory, and they would light up whenever he wanted them to without any wires attached.
That's just, and that is true. Well, of course, that is something that we can have today, and Mr. Matthews can develop that at any time. He has all of the information on that. That is, we will be able to eliminate all inside wiring. And coffee percolators or toasters or anything of that sort. They will have a little dial on them, for instance, and you will just tune in to the electric current.
Margaret, Eden Gray was just asking you a question, and you answered, and in your answer you said something very casual, and it was as though I were walking down the street and someone dropped a few bricks of pure gold in front of me, and I casually picked them up and continued walking down the street. I mean, this is very, very odd. I mean, your friend, Mr. Matthews, has said such and such, and a few space craft from outer space landed on his grounds and so on, and then we go into this, and you have a little dial and so on. What craft landed on Mr. Matthews' grounds?
Oh, you haven't read Return of the Dove?
Well, I'm afraid I was reading about Tesla and Otis C. Carr. I did not concentrate on Mr. Matthews.
Well, yes, Mr. Tesla gave, in 1938, he gave Mr. Matthews a design and specification for building the interplanetary communication set. Of course, Mr. Tesla was the father, grandfather of all radio and TV, as you know. That is, he developed all the necessary coils and so forth, which led to radio and TV. The interplanetary communication set, however, is something different. It looks rather like a radio set, but it does not operate on radio waves at all. It operates on cosmic ray waves. And Mr. Tesla had considerable experience in this field of cosmic rays because he built a cosmic ray oscillator one time, and also a regular cosmic ray motor.
So what about the
Well, then in 1938, Mr. Tesla gave Mr. Matthews the design, and he said when spaceships begin to approach the Earth, which they will do in a few years, why, you go ahead and build this, and you will be able to talk to the pilots and the crews. In 1947, Mr. Matthews had heard quite a lot about spaceships, so he built the Tesla Interplanetary Communication Set, and he has operated it since 1947. He had the first talk he had with the pilot of a spaceship was in 1947, and when he tuned in the set, he got a spaceship which is 25,000 miles above the set. And the pilot talked to him at some length, and then very shortly after that, they came down to see him.
Was that in French?
Oh, no. It was Mr. Matthews is English.
Oh,
I was speaking of Quebec.
Was this a vocal message, or was it
yes, it's very much like a radio broadcast. Mm-hmm.
We were talking about that ship, and I just found the passage now in Prodigal Genius, The Life of Nikola Tesla by O'Neill. And it says that Tesla staged this demonstration in the great auditorium of Madison Square Garden, which was then on the north side of Madison Square in 1898 as part of the first annual electric exhibit. He had a great big tank, and he had the ship in this tank. And then it turns, extending upward from his boat in the tank, were wires that served as antenna. And it was a wireless affair. And it says the boat could be put through the most complicated maneuvers. Anyone attending the exhibit could call for a certain maneuver of the boat. And Tesla, with a few touches on a telegraph key, would cause the boat to respond. So that doesn't sound like...
Well, I thought that when you said a ship, I thought that you were referring to that demonstration that he had held in an armory. But supposed to have been done by thought control, and that was described by Mr. Arnold Kruckman in Washington. I mentioned Mr. Kruckman in Return of the Dove. I don't think that O'Neill mentioned him.
No, this is remote control of a... ship, or it could be anything else, through the use of
wireless.
Well,
that's
done with modeled airplanes to a large extent, too. Mm-hmm. Done with real airplanes, but I still don't know about the aircraft, spacecraft that landed at Matthew's front yard.
Sure, so we can go on with that. No, his backyard.
In his backyard?
Oh, yes. So after he had had a few conversations on this Tesla interplanetary communication set with spaceships, then they told him that they would be down to see him soon. And he told me that one night the Tesla intruder alarm, which he has on his place, went off. And this was around 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. He got up and went out to see what was going on. And there was a large spaceship there in the back. It was 700 feet in diameter, and it had 24 little scout ships inside it.
Let me ask you a question. Whence did this come?
It's pretty big.
Yes,
you remember. You remember we had a guest here not about 3 months ago. It's all about 136 miles across.
Well, there was one that was over 1 million miles across, too, for that matter. But I'm talking, this was landing in the backyard.
Well, Mr. Matthew's backyard is rather extensive. He has 600 acres up there in the far
mountains. So where did this come from? Where, I know it came from 25,000 miles. What planet or galaxy?
Most of the people he has had many spaceships to visit him, but most of them have come from Venus.
Oh, that's a very interesting point, because I wanted to bring up on page 103 of the Return of the Dove, you indicate that Nikola Tesla's mother was possibly, as you said, it's fairly clear that she herself was originally a Venusian.
Yes, she must have been.
I was going to question the first statement. Now I want to know what it must have been. Why do you feel this?
Well, as I have... described her in there, she was such an unusual woman. And, of course, Tesla was born on board spacecraft and brought to this planet and placed in the care of Mr. and Mrs. Tesla. And she would certainly have to be a rather unusual woman to have accepted a...
What planet is he supposed to be?
Venus.
Venus also. Mm-hmm. Why is there... This great contact from Venus. Do you think, Margaret, this has nothing to do with your book or with Tesla especially, but do you think that all the contact stories that we've had are all Venusians? I mean,
No. As a matter of fact, it does have to do with the book, because I've written almost a full chapter on Planet Chimera, the Lord of the World, and he came here from Venus.
Well, you see, I really spent a great deal of time on the Nikola Tesla story in your book, because, as I said, it's just absolutely new to me, and I found it very fascinating.
Well, the book is so planned, however, that in order to check up on many of these points, you really have to read the...
Starting the study, but we also have the author Matthew's story, which we might as well sort of change over to right now, because we are discussing Mr. Matthews.
Is Mr. Matthews an engineer, do you know? I mean, as we recognize an engineer?
He is a professional engineer, yes. He's a professional engineer because he has passed the state board examination. But his training was only with Tesla.
Well, he was another student of Tesla, a direct student with
him? Well, yes. You see, Mr. Matthews' father was an electrical engineer for Lord Kelvin. And at one time, Lord Kelvin invited Tesla to come over there to his laboratory in connection with what Lord Kelvin called your newfangled wireless invention. And when Tesla went over there, he met Mr. Matthews' father and the son. Arthur H. Matthews at that time was a young boy. But after that, they always remained with Tesla. They came to America then and established St. Dunstan's Laboratory in Quebec. Mr. Matthews' father worked mostly, I think, in New York with
Are there any records, any written records, any place that can prove that these Matthews people did work with Tesla?
Oh, I don't know. I never thought about asking for any proof. I mean, Mr. Matthews, the senior, has worked on so many of the Tesla inventions, particularly the anti-war machine, that I should imagine that most of the drawings and so forth would...
What was the last one?
Yeah, I want to get in on that, too. The what?
What is that?
The anti-war machine?
Yes, the Tesla anti-war machine. I mean,
you say it as if, it's like something you pick up in Liggett's for 39 cents for 3/4 of a pound. They come in red, blue, and black, like jelly beans. I mean, this is supposed to work? What is it, first of all? Describe it.
Well, the Tesla anti-war machine, of course, has been described at great length in many scientific articles over the years. He completed the invention of it, or that is, the development of the invention, to the point where it was offered to the United States government in 1935, also to the government of Great Britain, and some of the other governments, I believe, France and possibly Italy and Holland.
Well, you know, Margaret, our government is now working on a machine similar to Tesla's anti-war machine.
No, I didn't know that.
It's been the last thing of our year. We are working on this, and it's one of the Blue Sky projects, as they are called. It's quite fantastic. If it works out, it will be very, very much the same as what Mr. Tesla was working on, and it would protect us from any kind of attack. Mm-hmm. In other words, atom bombs or...
How?
There's a magnetic field of some sort, of variety of species or color or dimension set up...
Other than the magnetic field as we know it today?
Well, this is, I believe, a security question at the moment.
I don't want you to divulge anything that shouldn't be divulged.
Answer, but what will happen is that there would be an invisible bubble put over the entire country, a huge bubble, and nothing could get through it. Although we can see through the thing, we'll see the sky, and if we look down for
a moment,
there'll be no spaceships to come back.
Nothing.
You're wrong, Harry, because it doesn't permit rain and things like this to flow through if necessary. It can be shut out, but...
It can be shut off for a moment, but if it's on rain or wind or clouds,
is it like a plastic bubble?
It would be in effect as though there were a big glass bubble, but there is nothing there. It is a field of pure force. This huge bubble over a city or over an entire country.
Well, could you just protect a country or the entire planet?
Well, this is a question of how extensive the device that is producing this bubble would be. And this is not a gag. This is very serious stuff that has appeared in the New York Times and the press. This is no joke. This is very serious.
The Journal had a story about a year ago.
Oh, more recently than that.
I didn't see the late story.
Yes, I spoke to some of the men who were involved in this project. And Nikola Tesla had an idea which was very much the same.
Well, Nikola Tesla's invention is not an idea. It's a workable plan and was offered to the United States government and was rejected in 1935. It
Mr. Matthews, of course, has the complete invention today, and it is still expected to be used, perhaps, in the event that people desire world disarmament. The Tesla anti-war machine is a form of a polarized curtain of light. It can now also be built with a ceiling, and it has the effect, however, of causing all bombs anywhere on the earth to explode once the switch is thrown, once it is turned on. It need not be all along a nation's borders, unless you just wish to establish protection from all sorts of things. If you just wish to enforce disarmament, it may be extended over just a small part of the border, and therefore it will cause all bombs to explode, and bombs cannot be used.
I can understand that perhaps Mr. Matthews up in Canada might know that the flying saucers come from Venus. This I can understand. He might know, but I don't understand, Margaret. Are you taking just his word for this, or have you got some kind of evidence or first-hand information about the fact that these spacecraft which dropped down at his little motel in the country were from Venus and not from someplace else?
Oh, no. I have complete confidence in Mr. Matthews.
I mean, it works by hearsay, then.
No, I have been up there to see him, and of course his spacecraft didn't come down while I was close. When I went up there, I was there a very short time because we had been delayed and I'd had to cancel about 3 appointments with him. So by the time I did get there, I talked to him about many things, and I saw the interplanetary communications set, but it was not operating just at that time.
Well, Mr. Carr is...
He operates on schedule.
Mr. Carr is working very seriously with him and Colton. All these engineers down in, or I should say his workmen down in Oklahoma City. What is Mr. Matthews doing? I mean, what is his main experiment, whatever you'd like to call it right now?
Well, Mr. Matthews now is he's sort of semi-retired, and of course he's an electrical engineer, a professional electrical engineer, and he has several large accounts, you might call them, or jobs, which he takes care of. I believe one is for the railroad or something, and I believe the telephone company.
Well, the thing that serves me is this. Did Mr. Tesla leave any records or diaries? And if so, does anybody have these? In other words, this would be brought forth.
No, Mr. Tesla left in his room in the suite in his hotel. A safe which contained a few papers, and these were taken by the United States government and examined, and later they were turned over to the Tesla Museum or Institute in Belgrade, Yugoslavia.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I didn't know there was a museum over there.
Oh, yes. You see, the Yugoslavs have always honored Mr. Tesla as a great national hero. In fact, their greatest national hero. And in the early 30s, I believe it was, they built this Tesla Museum and Research Institute, which they have maintained. This was endowed privately, but it was also supported by the Yugoslav government. They placed in the museum library every scrap of information they could get at that time pertaining to Mr. Tesla's...
Margaret, did you say that was in Belgrade?
And yes, it is there now.
Is it there still up in all the communist regime they have there now?
Oh, yes. Of course, I don't know that American scholars can do research there. I don't know just what the limitations may be, but it is used extensively, and that is why, or that is how, rather, the Russians... obtained all the information on the Tesla sphere, which our government did not use in 1917, and now they have developed the Tesla sphere and they have it in production.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Storm, as I understand it, Mr. Tesla, for the most part, thought of his invention
Ted, in his imagination, and he worked them out completely, so that by the time he started to make them out of steel and wire and whatever, they didn't have any bugs in them. In other words, he worked it all out in his head, and he put very little on paper, and that the engineers who worked with him, his helpers, never had any plans to go by. They just did what he told them. Sometimes he would scribble on a piece of paper a small diagram for them, and then they would have to, he would tear that up, and then they would have to go. So how did Mr. Matthews get a hold of 1,200 of Mr. Tesla's inventions?
Well, you see, Mr. Matthews was trained by Tesla. As I explained, it was Mr. Matthews' father who was an electrical engineer for Lord Kelvin and later for Tesla. And Mr. Matthews, Arthur H. Matthews, who is now lives in Canada, is therefore a man who was trained by Tesla from the time he was rather a small boy.
Well, you mean by that that Mr. Tesla gave him this in writing, or that did he just tell him about these things?
Mr. Tesla worked, as I have described, in Return of the Dove. He worked in what we call the fourth ether. His students, or those he trained, have similar ability to a certain extent, at least. And Mr. Matthews is an extremely modest man and a very humble man. And he has never gone into great detail in describing how he works. But I assume that he has many of the same abilities that Tesla had. And I know that Otis G. Carr also works along that line.
It seems to me a shame that a man like Mr. Matthews, who's the only person in the whole world who has these 1,200 inventions, knows about them, could work them out, has only done this interplanetary radio thing. And as I understand it, he's an elderly man, and are all these things going to be lost when Mr. Matthews dies?
No, nothing will be lost, and the interplanetary communications set was built according to instructions given by Mr. Tesla. He said, when spaceships are approaching the Earth, why, you may build this set. But the great thing that Mr. Matthews has of Tesla, and which is ready to be used and has been ready to be used since 1935, is the Tesla anti-war machine. And the Tesla anti-war machine includes true radar. Of course, the radar which we have, as I have described in Return of the Dove, is sort of a poor imitation. And that is because they do not have access to Tesla's anti-war machine, which contains the true radar operation.
Well, what is the difference between so-called true radar and the faltering type we use now?
Well, I don't know the difference, except that the type we have now doesn't work very well.
Well, it works pretty well, except when the ship captain decides both to turn left at the same time.
I want to slip something in here. Margaret, I came across something in your book, The Return of the Dove, which flipped me for a moment and sort of made me think of chiropractors and stuff like that. There was a reference to straightening out the Earth's axis in 1958.
That's right.
What does this mean?
Well, There was more than a reference to it, and the meaning was explained in there, but I will go over it briefly. The axis of the Earth during the 19 million years which have elapsed since the laggards came to the Earth.
Let's stop right here and go back. Not to the 19 million years. This I'll take your word for. I'm not quite that old, but
I covered 19 million years in 19 pages.
Pretty good. Let's get the laggards.
Yes, but don't forget about the Earth.
Let's find the laggards, but that's not like the names of the horses that I picked. You know. Who were the laggards? Was it L-A-G-T-A-R-D-S?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, these are evolutionary laggards, that is, individuals who do not keep up with their evolution, their their classwork, you see.
Like certain people we know.
That's right. And,
Mr. Lottman is not here to make remarks about him, please. I'm sorry, Margaret, go ahead.
You see, about 19 million years ago, well, in fact, it was a little bit longer than that, the planet Malbec exploded due to their experimenting with atomic bombs. This formed the asteroid belt. And naturally, when it exploded and shattered, there were a number of people on it, and the chunks from this various planet which formed the asteroid belt, many of them continued to be inhabited. I mean, they went into orbit. They were large enough to sustain life. And it's true that over a period of years, the people sort of decreased in size until they were rather like midgets, I believe. This has something to do with, I understand, with the gravity. And, of course, that depends on size of the planet and so forth. So at one time, these liggers, of course, anyone connected with Malbec was considered a ligger because the planet had fallen into discord to the point where they were experimenting with the atomic bombs. And at one point, these liggers were all rounded up, and a call had gone out through the various galaxies asking for some planet to take in the liggers. And as I have described in Return of the Dove, the Earth was so beautiful in those days, so abundant, so perfect, that it was decided that we could accommodate the liggers. That, of course, 19 million years later, we some of us may feel that a slight error was made. But at any rate, we took in the laggers. And it was very interesting if you will read a drawing about it. And I was in Inspiration House today, and I saw it down on Eden Graves.
You know, it was a very funny thing. This evening I was talking to someone. They said, you know, they said that book, Dweller on Two Planets, has never been mentioned on the Long John program. And then I wasn't going to say anything, but you did tonight. Isn't that true?
Uh-huh.
It's a very fine book. It is a classic.
Yes. And that describes in a very interesting fashion the bringing of the laggards from this particular planet of Malbec, which is sometimes called Lucifer because the planet was under the guardianship, so to speak, at one time of the fallen angel Lucifer, the light bearer. Of course, this means this expression fallen angel simply means that Lucifer was so anxious to assist the people on the planet that the angel took embodiment, human embodiment, and went down into the discord in order to try to help it. Now, this is described in Dweller on Two Planets, and then it is described how the liggers were brought in the spaceship. At the same time, some of the laggards came from other stars, other planets throughout this galaxy and adjoining galaxies. They were brought in and entered into the human family and so forth, but they brought, of course, their karmic memories with them, or their memories of discord, and it was not very long until the discord spread. And at that time, the situation became so serious that the Cosmic Council met and voted to dissolve the entire planet and just cancel the whole thing out.
And it was the first time that Planet
Canera, the Lord of Venus, asked if he might come to the Earth and try to straighten things out here. Now, speaking of straightening things out, we get back to Mr. Lanier's question about the atom. This situation of intense discord that developed
and the Earth as a result of the Lousies coming in here and bringing their memories of this world on their own planet, resulted in a situation which caused the trouble, the bundling of the atmosphere and the atmosphere. It is impossible, as I understand it, to explain this in our terms, that is, in our language. Because we simply do not have a which would enter into this. And so, anyhow, the answers have been posted now over a period of more than 20 years. And
Why don't we notice any difference?
Well, that's what I was getting to. When when staining of the ashes was first done,
who was doing this treatment?
The staining of the ashes was handled and carried by the angelic kingdom, because the ashes, as you know, is not a piece of metal or anything. It's a ring of
fluid.
Yes, that's
metal.
They're dealing with material.
Kind of like getting your wheels straightened on one of those alignment machines.
It's going along in a wobble or sort of cut.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was 45 degrees out of its office.
Which would not be noticeable.
Well, if you had lived here over millions of years, I mean, people had lived over millions of years under those conditions, they would not naturally, they accepted them as normal. And then when the axis, when the staging of the axis was started a little over 20 years ago, there was, it was noticeable to a few people, there was the difference in position of certain stars. It was noticed almost immediately. And a great wave of fear spread over the Earth, because this was reported in one or two papers. There seemed to be something little odd about stars. But they didn't receive very much publicity, but it did receive some. And after that, the situation of the star pattern was not allowed to cause any further fear, because, of course, naturally, they do not wish to add to the stress of the people and cause any sort of panic. So the entire star pattern, as I understand it, is now completely camouflaged. And it will be revealed whenever the people have reached a state of consciousness where they can accept this change.
Margaret, we've discussed sources, and we've discussed Venus for some time now, and other outer space matters. I'd like to sort of make this a little interview right now and sort of set the background a little bit, because we've sort of been jumping around. First of all, I'd like to know, have you tell us how many of the planets you feel are occupied by any known life? I'm talking now of our own 9 or 10 planets. I haven't counted lately.
WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 on the band. You want to answer that question?
Yes. I understand that all planets are inhabited.
That includes Mercury?
All planets.
All planets. Let me just close my own mind. You mean in all galaxies also?
Yes, in all galaxies. In other words, that's the purpose of a planet.
Now, in the we've heard that these many flying saucer reports and visions to the one you told us about with Mr. Matthews, and there was an actual landing. Would you say that all the flying saucer sightings we have heard about in the last 10 years, I guess is about what it covers, are from Venus, that all these flying saucers are from Venus, or would they be from other planets?
Oh, no, I understand that there are some many other planets, and planets outside the solar system, and there are also intergalactic spaceships, which we seem to call comets, but which are actually intergalactic spaceships. Of course, they're not exactly mechanical, but they do have a form, and they do carry passengers.
Well,
I understand. I haven't found one.
I've talked to many people about saucer sightings, including some contactees, as we call them. I was wondering why you feel that there haven't been any, what we might call, official contacts. In other words, have there been official contacts that we haven't heard of, possibly, between governments?
I understand that there have been many official contacts. That is, by that you mean contacts with the heads of government.
That's right.
Yes, I understand that they have all had official contacts.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that we have not heard about them?
Well, I suppose that for the same reason that we have not adopted the Tesla anti-war machine and have not heard of a lot of other things. It will mean a complete change of the situation on the Earth.
If the Otis T car X1 gets off the ground and then is used, this is going to change a lot of things. Also, why hasn't Mr. Carr been, shall we say, blacked out as much as some of Mr. Tesla's other inventions, for example?
Because of the Times.
The New York Times?
No, not the New York Times. Because the world, the time. The time schedule. In other words, in this particular age, this is the beginning of a new, not only a new cycle, a new 2,000-year cycle, Aquarian cycle, in which the rays have changed, the cosmic rays which energize each cycle have changed, but it is also the beginning of the final 2,000 years in which all the problems concerning the last 19 million years will be settled. In other words, the laggards and everything connected with the problems of the laggards must be settled during this age. That is the cosmic fiat which is gone forth. And the reason for that is because we are going now into a new orbit. And we cannot have all this discord because we will not be able to live in the higher frequencies into which we are now entering. In other words, we must have much more pure and refined physical bodies.
Well, do you feel that this new era we're entering means that there is no danger then of a couple of fools touching off a few hydrogen bombs and perhaps changing things a little bit?
I think there might be considerable danger, and that is the reason why it simply will not be permitted to happen. Because we are going into a new orbit, and the cosmic entities who are guiding this solar system and this galaxy will not permit any more planets to explode and form asteroid belts and that sort of thing.
Let me interrupt for a moment to take care of a little business here.
Margaret, there have been stories that I have heard about Otis T. Carr and Nicholas Turner, which I have been a little skeptical about. You may be able to straighten me out on this situation. It concerns Nikola Tesla asking Otis T. Carr to go out and buy bags of peanuts. Unsalted peanuts, I believe the story was. And then the two men of great brilliance would go out feeding these peanuts to pigeons, or the pigeons flew into Mr. Tesla's room, and Mr. Tesla said the pigeons were on the floor of his room. What is the truth of this story?
Well, that's just about correct. Mr. Carr was he came to New York to study art, and he got a job as a clerk in a package clerk in the hotel.
Do you know where he studied art?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't know whatever happened to the art. I don't think very much happened to it. Because the first day that he arrived here, he got this job in the package room of the hotel.
Do you know the hotel, what the name
was? I believe it was the one across from the station. That's now the Statler. I think it was in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Either that, yes, I think it's Pennsylvania, or the New Yorker. I'm not sure, but I believe it's Pennsylvania. And Mr. Tesla then lived there, and that day he came down into the, winding his way through the subterranean passages into this hotel, into this package room. And he walked up to this young man, and he said, When you have finished your duties here, I want you to buy 4 pounds of unsalted peanuts and bring them to my suite. This whole episode was very unusual because Mr. Tesla had never gone down there before, so far as anyone knew, and certainly the guests did not go down into that section. But that day he did go down there, and he did speak to Otis T. Carr, who at that time was just the young man, I believe he was 20 or so, not even 20. And Mr. Carr brought the peanuts to
him. Did you speak to Otis T. Carr about this story?
Oh, yeah.
I'm wondering whether he told you where he was able to find the unsalted peanuts and whether they were shelled or not shelled. I have a good reason for asking this question. I'm not being funny.
Well, because Tesla asked for unsalted peanuts, one would think that they were shells. I did not ask Mr. Carr about that, so I don't really know. But at any rate, Otis took the peanuts to the Tesla's suite that evening after work, and he was invited in to talk with the great scientist. And meanwhile, he had found that he was a great scientist and that he fed the peanuts to pigeons. And that evening, Mr. Tesla talked to him for about an hour and a half, and then this performance was repeated each day for 3 years. Most of the time, they left the hotel and went out and went on their raft and fed the pigeons. And as I have explained in Return of the Wild, much of Mr. Carr's training took place on the library steps. That is, on the Bryant Park side. Of course, that's been remodeled lately. I believe the steps are no longer there. But,
yes, the steps are still there on the Bryant Park side.
Oh, they are? Mm-hmm.
Yes, low, sort of low, very low steps leading down to the great big lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to hear more about this. This is very fascinating, about the teachings. I mean, how long do they spend together?
Well, it went on for 3 years each day, and they would spend a couple of hours together. Sometimes they remained in the hotel, and sometimes, as I have explained in Return of the Dove, Mr. Tesla would simply invite Mr. Carr to come in and sit down, and then Mr. Tesla would go on working, and about 2 hours later he would speak to Otis and say, "Well, you may go now." So that they would not exchange any words. And that was apparently to simply raise the vibrations. He used to send Otis out into the park to gather up any pigeons that might have broken wings and things of that sort. And Otis would bring them back to the hotel, and they would fashion splints for the wings and the lights. And
that's been a very kind man.
I believe he was, yes.
How old was Otis T. Carr at the time that he knew Tesla?
Well, he was very young. I mean, he was perhaps around 20 at that time.
And this is very curious. I understand that Otis T. Carr and Nikola Tesla were, you might say, associated or knew each other and transmitted information to one another over a period of about 3 years.
Yes, it was exactly 3 years. Mm-hmm.
And
then they never saw each other again.
I find it very interesting in terms of the explanations that Mr. Carr gives of his circular foil spacecraft and the means of propulsion in connection with the theories I have read of Nikola Tesla relating to gravity, which he had specific ideas about. And I found in the book of Eden Gray Hairs here, the one by O'Neill, a reference to the fact that Nikola Tesla was very unhappy about the theories of relativity and the various concepts of smashing the atom that we were getting into at his time.
Oh, yes.
His time.
Yes.
And then I find in Mr. Otis Picard's writing some words of praise of Einstein and relativity and claims that Einstein's ideas made it possible for him to complete his theory. This has me a little confused. I don't know if you could help me on this.
Well, Mr. Carr did go see Einstein and they had conferences together, and he thinks very highly of him. But the thing that both Mr. Tesla and Mr. Carr do not accept that is the confirmed splitting of the atom. Now, of course, Einstein's parents are not entirely concerned with the fission occasion of the atom. It's true that perhaps his contributions did lead to the fission and fusion of the atom. That is the thing that they were unhappy about, not about Einstein's theories in general, or his theory of relativity.
But, Mrs. Dorn, your book seems to me to be such a strange mixture of fact and, well, shall I say, what I consider to be complete fiction. I mean, one time you were talking about Nikola Tesla, one of the great geniuses that lived. I mean, this is factual, anybody can prove this, and then the next minute you're telling about an inner core of the earth where good people live, and a strange woman named Leonora with a strange machine. It doesn't seem to tie in at all. One part of the book, it seems to be so factual, and then the other part so completely fanciful that to believe that there are people living in the center of the earth, good people, and then other people tell us that the Dayrose live in the center of the earth and they're bad people, and I'm sure that nobody lives in the center of the earth.
Well,
I want to just be, I don't want to be rude, Margaret, but in the line of what Eden has just asked you, you had a story about a cave in Wyoming with some
Unusual symbols
in this cave.
Well, it's called Cave of Symbols, but it is in that cave, it isn't exactly a cave, it's a very where Leonora's machine is located today.
Is that open to the public?
Oh, no, this is an ascended master's retreat. It's an Ascended Master's Retreat maintained by Ascended Master St. Germain, who was in charge of this civilization of the Aquarian Age. But to go back to the one point that I'd like to bring out is that the tarot and darrows, I do not mention the tarot and darrows because I don't know anything about them. I haven't met any. However,
he's a good people from the center of the earth.
I don't know about whether they're in the center of the earth or not. But let's say we've met some good people.
I think Margaret is saying that she possibly doesn't buy the tarot stuff.
No, I think that there's something to the tarot and tarot story. I'm not sure that they're down there today, but a tarot and darrows never did live at the center of the earth. They live in tunnels or caverns that are right near the surface of the earth.
That's right.
In fact, Morris K. Jessup and I have had long talks on that subject. I knew Mr. Jessup quite well, and we discussed the tarot and darrows and the underground caverns some length on several occasions. And Mars said that he had found that these extensive tunnels in South America, in the Andes down there, where obviously an entire civilization of some sort had lived, and yet they must have been
just mining tunnels.
They must have been of what we would call midget size. And this to me, I have no, this is just my own idea now. I feel that these were probably inhabited, built by and inhabited by the, what we call the Luciferian hordes, which were brought in at the time that the laggards were gathered up from these little chunks of the blown-up planet of Maldek. And as I mentioned a little while ago, described the in Florence and Planet, because it seems from many things that have been said that these were very small people. Of course, mind you, they were not gathered up a few days after the planet was exploded, but perhaps a few thousand years, or maybe, I don't know, perhaps even a million years had gone by before they finally were brought to the Earth. And I believe that they had some difficulty in withstanding the sunlight and that sort of thing, and therefore did inhabit these underground caverns. But they were close to the surface of the Earth. It had nothing to do with the center.
Ellery?
Margaret, there's only one thing in the Return of the Dove that has me puzzled and confounded, and this was a description of the power that Nikola Tesla had to concentrate his mind and get himself to lift off the ground and float around in the air in his room. And I have never heard of this before reading your book, I mean in connection with Nikola Tesla. I want to hear more about this.
Well, we have to consider, first of all, that he was not an Earth man. He was from another planet. And I believe that this is the only planet in the system where people are not able to levitate at this time.
What planet was Tesla from?
He was from Venus, yes. And there are people levitate freely on all the other planets. And, of course, the Tesla naturally did not use his powers of levitation for just any ordinary purpose, but if he needed to use them, he did so. And he used what they call a cloak of invisibility. That is, it's again, it's like Tesla's polarized wall of light.
The dark force field.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how you would describe it in scientific terms, but it is very much like Tesla's polarized wall of light in this field. Tesla uses this. It is a they found a force field and cannot see through it.
This is like the sound that's being made by some scientists as a form of what they so called death ray, more or less. Like what I call to John's raising eyebrows about a dark force field, I think. It's used to knock off, electrical motors and things like that when we were. Our main worry supposedly was from airplanes. This is before the invention of the hydrogen bomb or the atom bomb.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I remember they used to send out beams.
They killed cockroaches with the black beams.
As far as they got with the black beams.
Cockroaches and grasshoppers at about 100 feet.
Mm.
Yes, Mr. Matthews has one of those bug killing devices also.
Well, Margaret, about this levitating power that Nikola Tesla had, was it something like doing a broad jump or...
Oh, no.
Or hopping up a high stair or something
like
that?
No, when you're ready to levitate, you just take off, and it's done instantaneously, and it was not necessary to gather speed or anything of that sort. And as a matter of fact, there is a close connection between... levitation, that is the understanding of levitation, and spaceships.
Margaret, would it be proper for you to reveal whether you have ever practiced levitation?
No, I do not practice levitation. I sometimes think that it might be very convenient.
Martin,
instead of waiting for buses.
It would be great for commuters.
Yes, that's what I think.
Well, what did Nikola Tesla do with this power?
Well, he frequently made journeys to far places. And, of course, he didn't have a spaceship, so he just used his own force field.
What do you mean, journey to far places? For what reason?
Anyone in Tesla's position, would naturally wish to mingle occasionally, at least with persons of his own caliber.
Well, I understand he did take many trips to Europe and gave lectures.
Oh, yes, that's true, too. But I mean, supposing that he might want to drop over to India or some such place and spend the evening with one of those famous sages that we hear about.
Well, wouldn't he do that in an astral body instead of...
No, adepts of the of that sort, that is what we term the white magic... adepts do not use the astral at all. Do not use any astral force.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear you say that, Margaret. There are many people who are not aware of it.
That's true. There's a great deal of confusion on that subject, and it's a very important point.
I don't quite understand. Could you explain a little further?
Well, briefly, we have what we call the three lower bodies, the four lower bodies, really, because the etheric and the... physical are actually two. And then we have the astral or emotional body and the lower mental body or the lower concrete mind, which we sometimes call a shopping mind. In other words, it's very helpful as you're going out shopping for groceries or something and you want to remember that you should buy a loaf of bread and a pound of butter and so forth. But then those four lower bodies serve these very practical material everyday needs. But for anything else, we use the higher mental body and the three upper bodies. There's the higher mental and the intuitive and the spiritual body. Those are the finer, more subtle bodies.
Well, when somebody that is more advanced, you say, travels, would want to go over to India or something, do they do, like I have read, leave their body on the bed and travel spiritually or mentally, or is that what you mean? Or do you mean that actually, if that, while he had been gone, while he was on this trip, we'll say to India, would it be true that if somebody came into his room, they would not find him there? Is that what
you mean? Yes, if he levitates. That's true. That's the reason he would levitate, would be because he would want to take the body with him.
Some people can levitate, say, a foot or 6 inches off the floor, but that would mean not only levitating, but then being able to fly with his physical body faster than the speed of light in order get there and back.
And this is done by raising the vibrations of the physical body to the point where they are so fine and so light that they can be completely controlled. And then when he arrived at wherever he was going, he would simply lower the vibrations of the physical body. That's the only purpose of levitation, is to take the physical body along.
No, well, but then there are people, as I understand it, in adepts in India, that leave their body in a certain place, for instance, like in the life and teachings of the masters.
Yes,
of the Far
that's
East,
true. Mm-hmm.
They left their body, and they said to somebody, don't disturb my body, I'm going
that's
to leave
true.
It on the couch.
Yes.
But the other people saw him and talked to the man, the master,
yes.
At, say, a 500-mile distance.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So there are two different ways.
Oh, yes. Well, you see, in the first place, there is a definite distinction between the powers of the unascended being and the ascended being. In other words, an ascended person simply means that they are not coming back to continue their evolution. They have completed their evolution. And the unascended means that we have still more work to do. Or
what was Mr. Tesla?
At the time that he was here in that one embodiment, he was unascended, but he did make his ascension, and he is not returning. And this was a rather special case, however, inasmuch as he came from another planet, he came to do special work, which he completed in one embodiment. That is very unusual, and it was only because of the changing time that was done.